thank you so much for coming today. It is with great pleasure. I'm Alex Thier, one of the Senior Rule of Law Advisors here at the U.S. Institute of Peace, and it's with great pleasure today that we open up this special session of the Afghanistan Working Group to welcome a very special guest who has come to us from Afghanistan via New York. First, I would like to introduce the President of the U.S. Institute of Peace, Dr. Richard Solomon.
Thanks, Alex. I'm not sure what I really have to do to open this session other than to say we're delighted that we have a full house here and cameras rolling for what is really quite an important session given the seriousness of the topic, because Afghanistan, as we note in our daily papers, is back as an issue that many people are concerned has not been high enough on the agenda given the problems that will be hearing about today. Tom Koenigs has just finished his first year as the special representative of the UN Secretary General, and he assured me that he really wanted this job. He's had several other assignments, was the Secretary General's special representative in Guatemala and the deputy in Kosovo, so he has been working in some of the most difficult conflict areas, conflict zones around the world, and it's an expression of his commitment to working on these problems that he's taken on Afghanistan, where he is trying to deal with all of the problems of trying to stabilize that country, but particularly looking at the human security and the human rights issues. Again, I think we're all aware that the level of violence in Afghanistan has increased dramatically. The Taliban is resurgent, and one can't look at Afghanistan without being painfully aware of the relationship to what's going on in the tribal areas of Pakistan, and I suspect we'll get off into that as well. The opium trade continues to skyrocket, and just before we came in, Tom was telling me that the size of the opium economy in Afghanistan is about half, 50% of the size of the legal domestic product, which indicates how much influence the opium trade and economy has over the situation in the country, and that the government increasingly is restricted in its rid of control to the major urban areas. So our speaker has taken on a great but extremely important challenge. And we here at the Institute are very pleased to have this session today. As Alex Thier mentioned, we have an ongoing Afghanistan working group, which brings together many different audiences in town concerned with this problem. It is the only regular forum in Washington for continuous attention to the Afghanistan situation. Last year, we worked with UNAMA, actually it was this year as well, the UN Assistance Mission in Afghanistan that is headed by Ambassador Koenigs, and we held a national dialogue on rule of law issues, just as one aspect of our work in this area. So again, we're really very pleased and honored to have our speaker today, the UN Secretary General Special Representative. So thanks so much for being with us. Please.
Thank you very much for this kind introduction. Thank you very much also for the possibility to speak to such a knowledgeable and numerous auditorium. And I see some of the people here much more experienced on Afghanistan than I am, so I will carefully reduce my statements to the last year, and also I'm open to all critique or all those who know it better. I came to Afghanistan a bit more than a year ago, and lately I've seen my briefings for that, and I have also seen how my first briefing to the Security Council in March was. And in March I had to convince the people in New York and the ambassadors that what we see in the South, the resurgence of the Taliban, is not more nor less than an insurgency. This term, which is at the moment no news at all, but was not accepted at all, because one was extremely surprised of the Taliban coming back, the resurgence of the Taliban. One has completely underestimated the challenge of governance in the South, because the resurgence of the Taliban was only possible because there was a vacuum, a power vacuum. The dealing with the South was basically done in a way that it was seen as a military problem, just to chase the Taliban out or to defeat them finally. And there were some, that was literally what I was told, there are some remnants of Taliban here and there, some small groups. I asked, how many are there? Well, 10, 15 each, and what will defeat them. And so in consequence, the mandate of ISAF was in the beginning only concentrated on Kabul, then it went to the north, and the south was far too long treated as a mainly military problem. The challenge of governance in the south was completely underestimated. And if we look at the reasons for the insurgency in the south, which is a multifaceted insurgency, we still find that at least 50% is either lack of governance or bad governance or alienating of tribes or just absence of a state in the provinces and in the districts. The Taliban have not been beaten. They have been chased out of the country. The leadership has moved into the neighboring country and has not been destroyed. They have been expelled. All this victory over the hearts and minds, which at the moment is so much in everybody's language, hasn't been seen. It was more that they have been militarily expelled. Also, we have completely underestimated, if not closed our eyes, towards the developments in Pakistan, where it was possible for the Taliban peacefully to regenerate, to regain forces, to settle themselves, to regain structures. And I have happily seen that the United States Institute of Peace has dedicated a panel to this subject in last November, and everything you need to know is in the minutes. Now, there is a big dispute at the moment, how much is this Pakistan driven? And there are a lot of Afghans who say, well, the only thing, it's an invasion of Pakistan. The answer is always, well, they're all Afghans who come in. Now there are Afghans living on both sides of the border. You have 3 million Afghan refugees in Pakistan. Half of them are born in Pakistan, so it's not quite clear whether they are Pakistanis or whether they are Afghans. Then there is a vivid debate how much of the problem comes from over the border and how much is local. In the beginning of the last year, everybody said, well, they are all coming out of Pakistan, which is certainly not true. Now, the governor, the Pakistani governor of the Northwest Frontier Province, Orakzai, has said they are maximum 20% of the problem comes from Pakistan. I think that's already quite a lot, 20%. It doesn't help to argue. Sure, any insurgency needs a safe haven or recovery area somewhere, better out of the country. And those who have followed the Vietnam War know very well what this safe area or the Ho Chi Minh path went, not through Vietnam, but through the neighboring country. How important it is to have a place to hide, to regenerate. And even if it's only 20%, it is very important. In the beginning of last year, the president, very annoyed, asked the international community and his ministers in a meeting, who are these people who fight me? Who wants to kill me? I'm coming from that region. Why do they fight? How can you find out that? This was a very healthy question, because if you don't know the enemy, you are not able to fight the enemy. If you don't know how they operate, where they operate, you will never win. So he asked, who are they? And the answer was a consolidated answer between among the international community with the military forces and the Afghans, some of them coming from the area, that they are very different types of fighters. They all call themselves Taliban, and even those who are not Taliban at all from the ideological side, if they are against the government and they fight, they call themselves or are happily being called Taliban. And the types of fighters are certainly these old leaders who have been ministers, who have been Mullah Omar, who are most likely outside the country. This leadership which still exists with a partly charismatic character. But there are also, as always have been in the movement of the Taliban, those who have raised in the madrasa and who are numerous, are without numbers. There can be very many. But there are alienated tribes out of the southern regions, out of the Pashtun area of Afghanistan, who have been subject to bad governance, have been subject to governors who rather increase the divide between the different tribes than to bridge them, have been also subject to corruption, have been subject to illegal business, have been subject to actions of military or police commanders they didn't appreciate. And you certainly have the opportunists. You have those who just fight because you get with the Taliban three times the salary you get as a policeman. So you have these different types. So none of the explanation, they're all highly ideological, brainwashed people who come over the border, is right, nor they're all Afghans, none of them are coming from Pakistan. It's a variety of, but one thing is certain, and this has been proven over the last year. It is an insurgency who has a certain local support, for what reason ever. And it's not a phenomenon which is completely coming from abroad, Arabs who are fighting. It's not all Al-Qaeda. There are links, but it's not all that. It is a real insurgency. I insist so much on that because it has consequences. There's good literature about insurgency. Those who have read the book of Jihab on People's War will find quite a lot of this. And the Afghans know how an insurgency fights because they have led an insurgency against the Russians. And there are different phases of an insurgency. The first is to try to establish themselves in the hearts and minds, in the villages, in the far out, far to reach mountains, and to get control over the countryside. That's always the first phase. The insurgency is in this phase. There are some districts the government has never had control, and now the Taliban have control. And the dispute is over this territory. The second phase is they try to get local bases, sanctuaries, bases where the government and military officials cannot go in, where they can keep over the winter. It was disputed whether they have managed to get these sanctuaries inside Afghanistan over the last winter. Most likely some, but not very developed, not very developed as training camps. The third phase would be liberated territories. That's how far the insurgency against the Russians went. The Panchi Valley was always a liberated territory, and even after the third phase, the insurgency has won over the Russian occupation. So it needn't go to the fourth phase, where they attack the province capitals, and the fifth phase, where they build a fixed army and march towards the capital of the country. So these phases are apparently those we see the insurgency fighting in the south. They dispute the government control over the villages, over the far away mountainous areas. They dispute the supremacy over policy. They come with institutions of law. Then they try to attack the provincial capitals, Musakala, the bigger towns. They try to get a liberated territory. Why do I explain this book of General Giap? Because if we see the insurgency in the south as such, we come immediately to consequences of this concept. The first one is this is a long-term concept. The Pashtuns in the faraway areas, Taliban or not, keep saying the Americans have watches, we have time. There is truth in it. An insurgency has a lot of time. They have spent 5 years to recover, either in hidden areas or in Pakistan, and to regroup, and they have managed to surprise us in spring 2006. They have a long time. This is a long time exercise. The second is an insurgency intends to involve the whole population. So they are numerous. They tend to be very numerous. I've said that the one sort of fighters, those who come from the madrasa, radicalized youth, are without numbers. When the Taliban came the first time, they have more flooded the country than conquered it. There was a massacre where 4,000 have been massacred in Mazar. 3 months, 4 months later, 5,000 others have come in trucks over the Pakistani border from the madrasas. They are absolutely without numbers. So if in the news we read today that they have killed in the south 40 Taliban, if we read tomorrow they have killed 120, it does not really matter. And the Taliban insurgency is completely insensible to losses, either in the civilian population nor in their military. They are not impressed by high numbers of losses. But the involvement of the whole population means also that they don't make a difference between civilians and military. It's an asymmetric war, and the collateral damage they cause is not seen as something negative or to be avoided or so. If one suicide bomber wounds a government official, one, and there are 30 bystanders killed and 20 wounded, it was a successful operation. If this is a foreign soldier, even more successful, and they praise it like that. So the collateral damage is none of their business and doesn't impress them. We have one new phenomenon, which is completely new for Afghanistan, that's the suicide bombing, and it has developed in the last year extremely fast. The first ever suicide bomber in Afghanistan was immediately before 9/11. the attack on Ahmed Shah Massoud, where they two suicide bombers from Morocco, I think, killed him. In the following years, you had one, two, three, four extreme. In 2005, you had 17 suicide bombers. That was the extreme. Last year, we had 139. The Taliban have announced last year that they would send 200 suicide bombers to Afghanistan. 139. They came pretty near to it. This year, they have announced they will send 2,000. The figures of the first 3 months indicate that they will not reach that much, but they will certainly be most likely double the number of last year. So this is a completely new element in their strategy. There are people who have studied the suicide bombing and have come to a pattern, particularly by looking into where you have no suicide bombings. Not so much where you have suicide bombing, because it's very difficult, because so far every explanation for the suicide bombing has been wrong. There are people who say they are brainwashed, long prepared, not true. There are people who are not Afghan, not true. There are people, they are all Arabs, not true. There are people who are poor, people who do it for money, not true. It's very difficult to give a pattern. Most likely you don't have a real pattern except some political ones. You don't have suicide bombers where you don't have a feeling of occupation. And this feeling of occupation by a nation which is first a democratic nation, so they are sensible to suicide bombings, and second, of soldiers with a different religion. That is apparently a pattern. If you don't take, which now is very popular in Iraq, the sectarian suicide bomber, where one group of the religion attacks the other by a suicide bombing. But throughout the history, you see that pattern, that suicide bombing you have where there is a perception of occupation and where you have foreign troops in the country which have a different religion. Just to look at it is at least interesting. The insurgency needs a legitimation of their war. And this legitimation is, legitimacy is developed on different levels, on religious level, on this question of occupation, the notion of the jihad, but also on collateral damage caused from our side. It is quite peculiar to note that each and every case of collateral damage where civilians were hit by a bomb is subject to huge agitation on the Taliban side. They don't care for their civilian casualties, for the civilian casualties they cause. But they use, and very effectively, the civilian collateral damage we cause. It all of a sudden, it's an element, and it's an element not only in Afghanistan, but also in the capitals where these soldiers come from. It's a part of this war on legitimacy. The legitimacy question has been very important in the Vietnam War, in Vietnam, and in the capitals, if you recall it. I have explained this so long and so cold-blooded because it has consequences for our strategy, for the strategy for the international community. And I will try to give you briefly four consequences. One, we have been surprised, we have made mistakes, we shouldn't repeat it. We have to look at the root causes and have to focus mainly on governance now, if we don't get the governance in the South right, we will not defeat the insurgency. So we have to have a major focus on governance in the South, where the territories are in dispute. That means rule of law, the institutions of rule of law, justice. The Taliban come and say, we bring justice. And if there is no other institutions for justice, the people are happy, because there is somebody who adjudicates a conflict they have with their neighbor over the size of their acre. If there is no justice, the Taliban have a point. We have to focus on the police. The police has to be there as implementer of justice. We have to focus on anti-corruption. There is an inquiry being made just a couple of days ago saying that 60% of the people feel that the actual government is more corrupt than the Taliban were. That is something everybody who has been in Afghanistan knows. If you ask the normal Afghan, even high-ranking, even intellectuals, you ask him who is more corrupt, this government or the Taliban, they say, well, corrupt the Taliban were not so much. The presence of the state in the provinces and districts is key. Now, you may say that is nothing new, but the main focus on governance is necessary and is even more necessary than other elements of development. The hearts and minds are not won by development mainly, but mainly by governance. We have to get the governance right. The second, we have to protect the civilian population, because that is a major point of agitation, a major point of disgruntling, a major point of Taliban attack, moral attack on our side. So we have to get humanitarian aid into the areas where there is war. We have to look after the internally displaced, because where we have war, you have internally displaced. We have to look after the victims, and we have to prevent collateral damage at all cost, because the cost is high. We had an incident where a suicide bomber attacked a military convoy. I still don't know who was the military convoy. So, and the soldiers panicked. The convoy started running. And a kilometer away, they thought they get under fire and started firing into the crowds. And the end was, and 2 kilometers further again. And the end was 11 civilians dead and 35 wounded. There were unrest in the place. And I'm absolutely sure that this fuels the insurgency. This fuels the general population who feel that is occupation. And those who are at the fence may turn over. So we have to deal with the collateral damage. There's always collateral damage in all war, but we have to know that this is a major strategic issue in this war. Don't misunderstand me. There is even a history in it. We are now, and I'm very happy as an activist in peace, I'm very happy that we are really sensible, that we suffer with the civilians who are killed. It wasn't like that in the Second World War. It was a completely different notion. Everybody said, well, the civilians, yeah, bombing is bad, but that's war. Now it's different. The media play a role, our mindset, and I think it's good. But we have to deal with this as an element. We have to avoid it at all cost. The third, this is a long conflict. Don't think that the insurgency will be defeated in 2 years. Don't think it will be defeated in 5 years. It hasn't been defeated in the last 5 years, and an insurgency is a long-term element. So what to do? The consequence the Afghan government rightly says is the conflict in the countryside, in the districts, in the villages, must be fought by the Afghans themselves. Because you will never be able to win it. You will more and more be seen as the occupier. You will not get that right. You have to capacitate the Afghan security forces to do the job and do it forcefully and do it now. I think we have a limited window of opportunity to make the Afghan security forces, the Afghan governance forces, capable to do it. They will do it more effective. All this I have told you on the insurgency, I have from the Afghans. They have fought an insurgency. They know how that is, and they have successfully fought it. The only ones who are able to defend themselves against suicide bombers by getting the intelligence, by infiltrating those circles who send suicide bombers, are the Afghans themselves. The only success against suicide bomber dismantling networks of those who have organized are national security service. Then, certainly since it's Afghanistan, they have the longer breath. They will be able to defeat in the long run this insurgency. The Afghan security forces have not this connotation of foreigners, of occupation, the occupation syndrome. And it sounds a bit cynical, even this sensitivity to collateral damage, they have not that much. All wars will have collateral damage. If the war is fought among the Afghans, they will be able to handle that. And last, the acceptance of casualties among the Afghans in this war is much higher, because we all know that there have been a lot of international soldiers killed in the last year, but what we don't know is 3 times more Afghans have been killed, because they feel that's our war, and they will not stop defending their democracy because they have had high casualties. So take into consideration the long duration and Afghanize the conflict. That is my main message. This Afghanization, that's the fourth point, needs building capacity in the national security and governance forces. The capacity development element in our development aid activity, the capacity development becomes more and more important and more prominent. The command of ISAF has lately said, and apparently he sees that the year 2008 will be decisive. Recall, a year ago, we didn't even know that we have something forthcoming. In the last year, the general view was we'll fight the battle in 2006 and we'll win it. This year, they say the next year will be the one. So it's serious. We have to make an enormous additional effort. I believe the COM-ISAF is right. 2008 will be decisive. Decisive in what? In governance, including judiciary, in enabling the Afghan National Army and the Afghan National Police to take over, and to make a major effort in the capitals to allow the Afghans fund them, support them to gain this capacity. I don't want to be misunderstood. Those who ask me, how long will the international community stay there? How long will our soldiers stay there? We will have to stay there for a very long time, because the power balance is such that the Afghan National Army and the Afghan National Police needs a backing up for a very long time. They need training for a very long time. But these day-to-day battles in the field, day-to-day battles in the villages, this has to be taken over by the Afghan forces as soon as possible. So we will not and we should not withdraw. We have to assure the Afghans that we will stay the course, but make them able to fight the insurgency. This view of the things has also a consequence for the north of the country, which is stable. We have made the mistake to see the south too much as a military issue and have underestimated the challenge of governance. We should not do the same in the north. We should stay the course in the north and stabilize the Afghan institutions. I give you one example, drugs. 3 years ago, there were 22 drug-free provinces. At the moment, we are happy that we have 8. If we would have focused on the drug-free provinces, we would have done better. Because to keep a province drug-free is possible. But to make a province like Helmand drug-free without having the military control is impossible. So we should focus on governance in the north. One last point I would like to make, that is on Pakistan. What I have said about the insurgency has a consequence in the handling of Pakistan. First, the military cooperation between the military cooperation with Pakistan has to be and has increasingly to be a military cooperation between Afghanistan and Pakistan, and not only between US and Pakistan or ISAF and Pakistan. They have to come together, because they have to fight an insurgency which touches both territories, which is threatening rule of law in Pakistan as it is threatening the government, the legally elected government in Afghanistan. The second, the lack of governance and state structures in Pakistan, the border area, is as problematic as it is in Afghanistan. So the support which finally was decided by the US government for the border areas in Pakistan is very timely and necessary. We have to focus on development aid in this region as we have to focus in Kandahar and Zabul and the other southern provinces in Afghanistan. They have the same problem. I would rather say that the democratic institutions in the Fatah area are so antiquated and still colonial that a major reform is necessary, which will only come through and with the support of international help. There again, it is a governance problem. And if the Pakistanis, together with international help, are not able to overcome these flaws in governance, we will not be able to resolve the problem in Afghanistan either. I'm very happy that the Institute has worked on that and I have profited a lot from reading the documents. Nevertheless, towards Pakistan, it is necessary to be clear. If Pakistan maintains the state of denial of any problem, or continue to deny that they have an insurgency problem there, it will be very difficult to support them. I was happy to listen to Governor Oraksai to say that it might be 20%, because at least he acknowledged that there is a major problem. I did not agree with what he said, that this is a liberation war, this insurgency. Nevertheless, one has to see that he expressed the voice of quite a lot of people in Pakistan, that this is a liberation war. I may add, it might even be a liberation war in Pakistan. But it has this connotation, and it has to be seen analytically clear. The whole region still is a region of threatening developments. And the threat is a threat for international peace and security. The threat comes through ideological challenges, they come through military challenges, they come through suicide bombers, and they come through destabilizing state structures, democratic state structures, and not or less democratic state structures in Pakistan. Nevertheless, one has to see that it is of utmost importance to realize that the development there is a threat to peace and security. I have spoken to you as people who know the details, and I am happy to explain further either the details or to listen to statements. My main point is, this is an insurgency. It has to be treated as an insurgency. An insurgency is nothing new, and we have to deal with it as an insurgency. Otherwise, we will not prevail and master this threat to peace and security. Thank you.
Thank you. That was a fascinating overview of, I think, and very insightful overview, and certainly one posed in a way that we've not really heard before of the challenges that Afghanistan is facing. And we're going to now have questions. And I wanted to start out with one to you, Ambassador Koenigs, that comes directly from the recent report that you or your boss gave to the Security Council this week, that I think is very tied to the remarks that you made in terms of the legitimacy of the government. And that is to ask you to comment on the question of this amnesty bill. And the reason that I raise the question of the amnesty bill in the context of your remarks is that one of the things that you have pointed to is a widespread dissatisfaction among the population with the ability or willingness of the government to deliver justice. And there was concern that this amnesty bill, which would forgive all past crimes and possibly even some future crimes, would challenge further the legitimacy of the Karzai government by showing that it was not interested in pursuing justice. You have called in your report you've called this, I think, a problematic development in your report, and I understand have worked potentially to have some language in a Security Council resolution that would address this question, and I was hoping that you might take up that question.
I happily do. the insurgency in the South has consequences on the mindset in the North. The prices for a Kalashnikov in the North has tripled. So apparently the mindset is not disarm, but to rearm. And there are people quite frightened that the Taliban might prevail. And so the Northern Alliance commanders have gathered and have tried to formulate, or are still trying to formulate, a political project of unity. Now, they are very dispersed people gathering, and maybe they would never have gathered if they wouldn't have been threatened actively and convincingly by a report which named the war criminals of the past, according to reports over the 20 years of conflict, plus the execution of Saddam Hussein. And some of those people saw their future in rather bleak terms. And that has brought them together. That has brought them together in a moment where the president had just promulgated a strategy for transitional justice, a very cautious and long-term strategy, nevertheless a strategy which was meant to honor the victims, to bring them into their right, to strengthen their voice, and give them back their dignity, and to find out about the history. This process of transitional justice, which eventually, in the end, might end up in trials and convictions, is usually in post-conflict countries a very long one. In my country, Germany, it took 50 years. In Spain, it might even take longer. In Argentina, it took 20. In Guatemala, I've worked after 20, it has still not really started. So to think that will be a fast process may be exaggerated. Nevertheless, for quite a number of people, having some of the war criminals in high positions or in parliament is an insult. And under these two tendencies, the ex or warlords have said, this is the moment to make a reconciliation bill. And the reconciliation bill had as main subject amnesty for those who have fought. We need them all. We have to win against the Taliban, and we can only win by a coordinated, cohesive action. And the parliament was the place. And they quickly got the majority with the bill, which was not a resolution, but the notion was clear. The heroes of the country are those jihadi leaders who have been active in the last 20 years. Now, there is a notion of threat from different sides, from the South insurgency, but they felt also threatened by people like us, the United Nations, or the Afghan Independent Human Rights Commission. So they made demonstration in favor of this amnesty bill, a demonstration which had
banners
with death to human rights, most likely meant Human Rights Watch, and also very negative connotations with UN and all those who are for transitional justice. It's always popular to call the unity of the nation in view of an attack on the nation. It's always popular to promise amnesty if you have a country where the different factions have fought each other over 30 years, because there are quite a lot who may profit from an amnesty. We have discussed at length with the president and have come to a result that we have to eliminate two things out of this bill. One, amnesty for war crimes and crimes against humanity. And second, a reconsidering of all the international treaties in the parliament. Both would be unconstitutional and very detrimental for human rights standards in the country. And we have achieved that. What we have not achieved in these negotiations was to eliminate the whole notion of, and now maybe the savers of the nation are again the jihadi leaders. So the bill as it stands now is very ambiguous. Plus, in one respect, it is ambiguous whether still the state prosecutor, remains the one who prosecutes and triggers off the trials against past human rights violators, or whether it is only the victims who can do so. That is still open. The president thinks the state and the victims can do it. Those accused of human rights violation think only the victims can do it, so responsible will be only the direct perpetrators. So the question is still open. I'm not as worried as others on this subject, because this will be a subject which will accompany us most likely for the next 10 years without a result in a trial. Because if we would have a trial now, they would be absolved. The judiciary is so weak that they wouldn't come to a verdict against one of these powerful men. But what is worrying is that all of a sudden we have a political force which is composed by warlords who think of everything else than disbandment of illegal armed groups or disarming or giving the power to the people and not to the militias or to their paid security firms. That is threatening. So the situation is difficult. It is a direct consequence of the weakness in the South. The government legitimacy is weakened by that, because these forces which are in the parliament are not genuinely democratic forces, to put it mildly. Looking at the actors in Afghanistan, I am still convinced that the most likely to be in favor of human rights and justice to the victims are the president and the foreign minister. So for a post-conflict country, and I've seen several, it's still a good disposition. Nevertheless, people say rightly, the president is weakened and the foreign minister is only one among a big cabinet which includes some warlords.
We'll take, we'll take other questions. If people can come to the microphones, unfortunately, because we are recording this, so I'll ask that. And Dennis, first out of his chair, please.
Closest to the mic.
If you could also introduce yourself when you ask a question.
Well, Dennis Cooks from the Woodrow Wilson Center. Thank you very much for the illuminating and balanced and honest presentation. One thing you only talked about tangentially, I wonder if you address now, that's what your recommendations are in dealing with the drug problem.
I didn't touch that at all. let me be very honest. There was a dispute a year ago whether alternative livelihood or eradication. We were all on the side of the alternative livelihood, and there have been invested in Helmand nearly $1 billion in alternative livelihood, and still Helmand is the world's biggest heroin producer. On the other hand, nobody would be against alternative livelihood for poor farmers who have nothing to cultivate except poppy. I have touched it with the drug-free provinces. I think to maintain, where we have the possibility of governance, to maintain the status of drug-free is a good thing. In places where government doesn't have control, the security forces don't have control, to invest in alternative livelihood will not convince any farmer who can make 10 times more on poppy. So we have to focus on good governance, including eradication in those provinces where it really makes a difference. Because if we both are farmers, and this year you start growing poppy, and I say, well, in the end they will eradicate, and at the end of the year you tell me, there you are, after 10 times I will grow next year poppy. But if I tell you at the end of the year, I told you they will eradicate your, and now they have eradicated and come to me and you want a loan. So what? Then eradication was successful. So where we have control, where we have good governance, we have to prevent these provinces fall into cultivation of poppy. Where we have no control, we have to gain control first. And then we have to deal with that. It is also a long-term problem, and none of the countries which in the end became poppy-free have done that in a very short time. In Helmand, and that's what ISAF does, and rightly does at the moment, they try to get control. We have even an additional problem, and the governor of Helmand has vividly advocated this. In a small area of Helmand in the center, the government is in control. In a bigger part in the north, they are not. The governor said, if you come and eradicate in the area where I am under control, where we are in favor of the government, and you are not able to do it in where the Taliban are in control, I tell you what will happen next year. They will all go to the Taliban because they can cultivate poppy. So please focus your eradication on the whole territory of Helmand, which is very difficult. So the consequence for me is where we don't have control, we will not be able to eradicate a lot. Where we do have control, we have to eradicate. In addition, there was a debate whether one can eradicate with spraying or not, but we have identified more or less convincingly that the advantage of spraying over manual eradication is minimal, and it may open a political front which is difficult to win. And the president said, and it will not be Khyber TV which will criticize me, it will be BBC. And right he is. So we didn't open that one, but manual eradication where there is control, interdiction, yes, and strong judiciary. I keep advocating governance, judiciary, national security forces. By the way, it was not only my advice or my advocating. There were others who have identified this priority, and I'm very happy that the United States and the supplementary budget focus on this with heavy money, police and Afghan National Army training. This Afghanization of the national security forces has been taken up by the United States. I would appreciate if other nations would take this rolling ball also.
Hi, my name is Mindy Reiser with the United Nations Association of the National Capital Area. For many women all over the world, the transformation, the beginning transformation of the lives of Afghan women were very exciting, were illuminating and moving. I want to ask you what has happened there. We've certainly seen stories of retrenchment of women, young women, girls who are going to schools, intimidated, their parents attacked or made to not send their children to school, particularly the girls. What is happening there? Is the Taliban capitalizing on a residual feeling that women do not belong in school, do not belong in the professions? And if this is so, what is the Afghan government able to do? I know the NGOs have tried so much. One NGO I'm affiliated with supported the underground schools. And this was a sense of hope and affirmation for women all over the world. How serious is the backsliding, and how can it be reversed?
First of all, today is the day of the new year, which is a happy day. All those who celebrate, congratulations to the day. The ones who celebrate this are the school children, because a new school year is opening. Never, ever, so many school kids have gone to school in Afghanistan than now. And the enrollment is 6,080,280, which is that was the UNICEF press conference. That's why I recall it. Roughly a third are girls. Never before so many girls went to school. Yes, the Taliban don't like it. Yes, the Taliban don't want girls to go to school. And the dispute, the ideological dispute, is ongoing. And there are attacks on schools. But there are also communities who defend themselves against the attacks. UNICEF has chosen a policy of not publishing attacks on schools nor reconstruction of schools. Because if this is another victory of the occupiers, they have managed with committees, community committees, to reconstruct all schools which has been attacked. Some have been reopened, some not. The girls' schools are under attack in the south, but nevertheless, we have more girls enrolled in school than ever. This is a cultural dispute. That's not a military and not only a reconstruction dispute, but a cultural dispute. If you look back at the European history, it's not that long that women have gone to school. And only the generation of my kids have the same number of girls to school than to high school than boys. So we have to see that this needs a certain time span. But there are activists, particularly Afghan women, who promote that. I'm very happy that the president never forgets it in public speeches to tell the people and send your daughters to school. He doesn't only do it on the 8th of March, but he does it constantly. And that helps. The international community has helped a lot. And I see steady, slow progress. Nevertheless, it's a battle, but for once it's not an uphill battle, but it's a battle which can be won. So just for information, it's obvious that it needn't be like that. The Iranian society is a very traditional society, and they have the girls going to school and university. So it's not necessarily like that, and I think there will be a positive development. I don't see a setback. Every school attacked is a violation of the human rights of education, and every school attack is a setback. But every committee of elders supporting girls' schools is a progress, and I was very happy we opened an office in Saranj, which is in Nimruz, right at the Iranian border, and I was very short. I didn't have any time, but the governor wanted desperately not only to open the office, but also to show me one project. And it was a huge girls' school, with really, I think, 600 girls at school. That was fascinating. It's really moving. And so we are optimistic.
Thank you.
Great.
Grant Smith of the Central Asia Caucasus Institute. I agree entirely with your emphasis on governance, and particularly rule of law, court, security, things like that. Clearly an area that the international community did not emphasize enough at the beginning and was very slow to work on. However, by only talking about those, aren't you accepting the Taliban's agenda? In the sense that these are things that the Taliban did. I mean, one can argue the only things the Taliban did when it was in power was provide security, provide some courts, and some madrasa schools. Doesn't the international community have to not let the Taliban set the agenda and insist that it's going to do and be seen to be doing a lot more things? And if so, to what extent can it do those things even in the least secure areas? You already talked about schools, the possibility of actually continuing schools in areas of conflict. Are there other things that continue to be done in areas of conflict?
If I have been misunderstood, I'm very grateful that you raised this. This is the fifth poorest country in the world, and it deserves, and the population deserve, development all over the country. We have a conflict in the south which hampers our development activity. Let's not fall into the other extreme and say we resolve that militarily. We will not be able. We will not succeed. We will succeed in governance, cooperation, focusing on governance. Certainly we dispute with the Taliban the development aid, because the Taliban is isolation and no development whatsoever, not even in schooling. And the brand mark of the Taliban is no development. That's quite clear. But we have to enter into the terrain where the farmers, who don't think of development in the first place at all, but they think, and that's what they ask for. They ask for security. They ask for decent government, say, services. They ask for being taken seriously by district governors. They ask for justice. And we have to compete with that, with the Taliban, and compete successfully. We have to be better at that for the Taliban. Otherwise, we will not win it. The decision whether the Taliban will succeed or not will not be made in the development field, but in the governance field. Then we can come in with development. But I think it's wrong to say we build a road and then they will be on our side. No, they will not. It's not enough to say we invest in so many schools and then they will be on our side. It's not true. And in addition, the mistake, as you rightly said, the mistake was to open power vacuum in areas where we could have known that the state was never there. Governance was never there. And it is a major venture, it's a major challenge to bring the governance there. And it will be a major challenge for the Pakistanis to bring governance, modern governance, not colonial governance, to the Waziristan. But I appreciate that you say the development activity we do so successfully in the north, we do in the center, we do in Kabul, we have to continue. My plea is a enormous additional effort in governance to win the country and to dispute it to the Taliban.
Yes, Mike Jaites from the U.S. Institute of Peace. I very much appreciated the strategic assessment you've given us and the framework and priorities I wanted to ask you about one element that seems to be missing, or how you would integrate in negotiations and diplomacy into this. The Taliban, as you mentioned, is a diverse group, but under what circumstances is it possible to negotiate with them and bring them into the fold, and when should we not do this? Taking into account the situation in Musa Qala, where the British military forces negotiated an agreement, but that seemed to have simply left open a power vacuum for the Taliban to fill. We have Gulbuddin Hekmatyar seeming to sue for peace. We can see some disputes taking place in Waziristan between the Uzbeks and local tribal chieftains. So what opportunities do you perceive for negotiations, and what rule of thumb would you give us for when it might succeed and when it's not appropriate?
The president rightly said on this question, we will not negotiate the constitution. And everybody in Afghanistan is aware we finally have a constitution, and that should be the benchmark for all negotiations. Nobody could negotiate the constitution. Everything else is possible to negotiate. And that's why the president, for instance, said, if Hekmatyar wants to negotiate, let's negotiate and see. I see the Musa Qala agreement a bit more positive than you do, because some of the problems we have in the south, and I have mentioned that when I spoke about the different types of fighters, some are just disgruntled tribes. So a negotiation between different tribes, and some of them we have brokered, can be very successful and can bring the disgruntled off the Taliban, because everybody who is against the government in the south is Taliban, and there are so many different types. I was very happy that in a military particular difficult situation, the British couldn't keep the Musa Qala, they made an agreement among elders, somewhere Taliban, somewhere not, and this has brought the city 5 months absence of war. It's something. Then it failed. These local deals have to be made on the battlefield for military reasons, as this one, or for reasons to get peace, and we will support that wherever it is. And some will fail, some will go well. I think the Waziristan deal has not done a lot of good, because quite a number of elders have been killed. They speak about 200, and at the moment they are fighting between the Uzbeks and the elders. But we always have to try to come to a negotiated peace, but without jeopardizing or diminishing the constitution. That is the main achievement, more than everything else, and people are well aware. I know that the insurgency cannot be won by military means. People say by military means alone. No, by military means, because there are too many. It's not just a glass, it's an ocean where they can recover. The madrasas can just spit out another 1,000. People who fight for money, you get thousands. So the solution can only be a somehow negotiated solution, but certainly the military pressure at the moment is enormous on the south, and there has to be a high level of military activity to get the conditions. We have to look into each of these possible negotiations. We have brokered some, which we haven't published. It works. And still, 50% of the problem in the south is a problem which, through good governance, good negotiation, can be settled. And in the end, it will only be the Afghans who resolve it. Even the Afghan-Pakistan conflict can only be resolved through Afghan-Pakistani cooperation. And that's why I'm very much in favor of these negotiations, and I hope we get more opportunities. Thank you.
Due to the shortness of time, we're going to have one very quick final question and a quick final answer. Please, go ahead.
Okay, good afternoon. My name is Sofia Magnusson. I'm an intern at the Swedish Embassy. Could you please comment on two issues? First, on the risk of the insurgency to spread to the northern parts of Afghanistan, and also if you please could comment on Karzai's popular support among the Afghans.
I don't see this insurgency easily spilling over to the north. If you look at the worst case scenario, we all have that somehow in mind there, the worst case scenario is a perpetuation of insurgency in the south with a lot of loss and attacks, and a destabilization between the warlords in the north. So we come gradually back to the times before 96, before the Taliban came in the north and a Taliban time in the south. That's the worst case scenario. A continuation of the 30 years of war. That's what we have to prevent. So I don't see a mechanical spillover. Karzai is not as popular as he was when he was elected. But what elected is as popular as on election day 2 or 3 years later? I've gone through that. Mrs. Merkel was very popular on the day when she became chancellor of my country. Now she is much less popular. But Karzai has one enormous advantage I never had as a politician. He has no alternative. We have to live with him. He is the one the Afghans have elected. He has done well. He has maintained himself in power, which is not so easy there. He is a democrat. He has a sense of human rights. We don't have any better. So we support him. Thank you.
I want to thank you so much for coming today and providing all of your insights. And as you go, we're going to give you a book, a recent publication, 21st Century Peace Operations, from the U.S. Institute of Peace and edited by Bill Dirch. It has an extensive chapter on Kosovo, which might interest you from your past experience.
Today, more than that.
And it also has a very large chapter on Afghanistan, which, of course, you're not responsible for because it was all written before your time, but maybe there are some insights that will guide you along the way.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
I hope I could make my point.
I'm sorry, the person who I didn't let ask a question was Alma.